sir.
Welcome, everyone. happy birthday, Hillary. It is our pleasure to have with us this week Rabbi Jaffe, Rabbi Gedalia Jaffe. Rabbi Jaffe is the rabbi at AY Ahavas Yisrael, located on Raritan Avenue. He is also a Rebbe at the Frisch High School up in Paramus. And I've known Gedalia for a long, long time, I think through my brother. And it's a pleasure to have you finally join us this week.
Hi, everybody.
Can you tell me a little bit about this? Is a group that meets how often?
Every week.
Every week? Oh, fantastic. They have a spread like this every week? Yeah, not bad, Rabbi Lewis. Ooh, okay, I have to come by more often. So I want to just talk. I want to schmooze, really, you know, with everybody. So I guess by way of an introduction, if there's anything I say that's unclear or questionable, please, you know, this isn't class. Don't raise your hands. Just feel free to shout out, ask any questions. Any terms or whatever, if I use that are not clear, if you can't understand my Californian accent, then please feel free to ask. I passed on some source sheets we'll get to in a second. But there's a true competition they have amongst linguistics. These people, like, study words, the etymology of words, how to use them correctly in a sentence, and they have an international competition. I can't make this up. They have a competition as to, like, how to correctly use words. So, several years ago, the finalist who, in his linguistics competition, was they asked you, in a clear sentence, explain the difference between being complete and being finished. Complete versus being finished. So he thought, and he responded, if you marry the right person in life, then you are complete. And if you marry the wrong person in life, then you are finished. And if the right person catches you in the arms of the wrong person, then you are completely finished. And they loved it. They gave the guy a standing ovation. He won the competition. I saw the signs. There was like a wine testing. They actually gave the guy a case of wine, a whole prize. He got to meet the Queen of England. It was a whole treasure package for being able to correctly identify and succinctly explain what the difference is being complete versus being finished. But joking aside, I think relationships on all levels are something important, something that we think about, that we deal with. All types of relationships. It could be a teacher to a student relationship. It could be a boss and an employee, co-workers, parent, child. It could be male and female relationships. But these are types of things that people really deal with. And you blink your eyes, and all of a sudden there's more and more, you know, self-help books how to deal with relationships. They tell a story. Somebody goes to Barnes & Noble and asks the person behind the counter, could you explain to me, can you tell me where the self-help section is? He says, yeah, but I think that'd be counterproductive, you know, wouldn't it, to show you where the self-help section is? There was a couple that got married, and they had a 50th wedding anniversary. 50 years together. And at the celebration, the friends and family came to celebrate this wonderful accomplishment of being married for 50 years. And the woman gets up and says, I want to give a toast to my husband for 50 years of putting up with me. She says, oh, so nice. Okay, they got it. And he gets up and he says, I want to tell everybody here that the 50 years of my marriage, they feel like on 2 days. Sounds like a nudnik in the crowd who asked, you know, why do you say such a thing? 2 days, you know, I don't know, say 1 day, say it's a week. Why do you say 50 years of marriage is only like 2 days? And he says, well, I'll tell you, the truth is, it only is like 2 days. It was like Yom Kippur, it was like Tisha B'Av, the two most difficult days in the Jewish calendar. I was Googling some statistics. I don't know how to do real research, so I just hit Google. And I wanted to find out in relationships. If I ask you guys, how many marriages do they say, unfortunately, ends in a divorce? 50%, right? That's a pretty surprising statistic, right? It's done. That means at every chasen you go to, every wedding you go to, so one out of two of them is going to end in a divorce. It's unfortunate. I'm just talking across the board. That's what they say. So I wanted to find a little more statistics. And again, I Googled this. This isn't really an official research. But I found the following. 1 second, let me find it. 50%. So that comes out to as follows. In America, there'd be one divorce every 13 seconds. every 13 seconds, 6,646 divorces per day. I'm assuming that's worldwide. 46,523 divorces per week. So why is that? You know, this didn't happen years ago. What's going on? That, like, people just can't stay in a relationship. So I'm asking you, what would you say is probably the top few reasons why people unfortunately get divorced?
Infidelity.
Infidelity is one of the top five. What else?
Money.
Money. Finances is one of the top five. What do you think?
Kids.
Kids. What do you mean?
Conflict.
Conflict with different styles in raising kids. Okay. Any other suggestions? These are all accurate. Poor communication. Poor communication is one of the reasons they give for unfortunate relationships failing. And one of the reasons they're no longer attracted to each other. So you think, well, if you married before, then the chances of getting it right goes on. You know, your second marriage will be better. Your third marriage will be better than your second one. Your fourth marriage will be better than that, right? Celebrity marriages. How many times do the most celebrity... who gets the award, I should say, phrase it differently. Which celebrity has been married the most times?
Larry King.
Larry King? No, not Larry King.
Elizabeth Taylor.
Not Elizabeth Taylor? Close. Zsa Zsa Gabor. Zsa Zsa's been married 9 times. 9 times. But the last one, her current husband, they've been going for 27 years. So I guess I'm trying to figure out age-wise how often that would be if you got married 9 times. What's the shortest marriage ever? Belongs to celebrities. I'm not acting.
Kim Kardashian. No.
Britney Spears and?
One
Jason
day.
Alexander.
Jason Alexander were married for 55 hours. 55 hours. Which celebrity had the highest payout to his divorcee? I'll give you a hint. Big anti-Semite.
Mel Gibson.
Mel Gibson. How much did Mel Gibson pay his divorcee? $425 million. Right? So I got some good news. We live in New Jersey. In terms of the states with the level, the ratio, I should say, of divorce. Again, this is only Google. This is not like real statistics. But according to this, the 5 lowest states for divorce rate, Hawaii 9.4, Massachusetts 9.1, New York 8.4, and our state of New Jersey 8.2. The lowest state is North Dakota, 8.1. So if you want to have a chance to have a successful marriage, everyone should go move to North Dakota. They're jokes, but I think there's a real issue, and we know that. So I wanted to try to understand a little bit, how do we create positive relationships? How do we interact with others in a way that creates a real bond and a harmony? Because unfortunately, there's so much of a disconnect in this world for all the reasons that you guys were saying. These things, creep up. You guys have heard of Golda Meir, right? Golda Meir was the prime minister of Sri Lanka. No, Israel. Okay. So when Henry Kissinger became the Secretary of State, she sent him a letter, and she says, "I'm so happy that we'll have another Jew in a powerful position in America." So he wrote back, and he says, "My dear, respectful Mrs. Golda Meir, I want to tell you 3 things about myself. First of all, I'm an American citizen. Second of all, I'm the Secretary of State. And third of all, I'm a Jew. That's how I define myself. I'm an American citizen, I'm the Secretary of State, and I'm a Jew." So Golda Meir writes back to him and says, "That's amazing. That's fantastic. Because in Israel, we go from right to left." I want to try to present a little bit of a way of going around outside of the box, trying to look at things from a different perspective. Yeah, I put out some source sheets. We'll go through a story we recently read in the Torah about Rachel and Leah. So again, you have the English on here as well. I'm just going to read a little bit in Hebrew and explain as we go. Now, the story is about Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, of Yitzchak, who was the grandson of Abraham. And this is one of the first Jewish weddings that we have described in the Torah. Ululavan shtevonos shema gadola Leah v'shema katana Rachel. So Lavan had 2 daughters. The older one was named Leah, and the younger one was named Rachel. Any ladies here named Rachel or Leah? No? Yes? What's your name?
Leah.
Okay, good. So in English, Leah, Leah. So it says, Ve'ene Leah Rakos. Leah's eyes were tender, literally soft, weary a little bit. V'Rachel Haisifas Tor V'Fas Mare. She had beautiful features and a beautiful complexion. Ve'yehav Yaakov es Rachel. This is one of the only times that the Torah actually uses the word love. There are three times in the Torah that use the word love. Here is interpersonal. It's Yaakov loves Rachel. Another one is the mitzvah to love every single Jew. V'yahavt l'reicha. It's the second time the Torah uses the word love. And what's the third time the Torah uses the word love?
Shema.
V'yahavt es Hashem Elokecha, to love God. So if you think about it, they're almost like concentric circles. When we love people, it's very easy for us to love those who are in our immediate surroundings, family members, spouse, child. Then that expands from the love like Jacob and Rachel, that expands to a little bigger. And we talk about love your fellow Jew, to treat your fellow Jew like you would want to be treated yourself. And ultimately comes that abstract concept of loving God, loving the creator of the whole world, something I can't touch, can't feel, I can't put my finger on it. But the idea of love, those are the only three places in the Torah where it uses the verb love. So we continue, where are we up to? So, this doesn't happen nowadays. V'yehav Yaakov es Rachel. Yaakov falls in love with Rachel. V'yomer evcha sheva shanim b'rachel bitcha haketan. I will work for 7 years for your daughter. Nowadays, when you go out dating, you don't promise your future father-in-law, I'm going to work, 7 years in order to get your daughter to marry me. They tell a story about a young couple that's dating for a while, and in their late 20s, and it's getting pretty serious. So he says to his future father-in-law, I'd like to ask permission to marry your daughter. It's okay, I give you my permission. She's okay, so he proposes, she accepts, and the father's so happy, he says, look, I want you to know something, me. By me, family is family. You're coming into the family, and I happen to know, I'm sure you're aware, I happen to have a very, very successful business. And since you're here, we're shaking hands on it, you're marrying my daughter, I'm making you partners with me, I'm giving you 50% of shares in the company. Wow, you got this 24-year-old kid who's now like a multi-millionaire. Says, okay, tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, you're going to come down, I'm going to put you on the factory line. You're going to start overseeing. Says, no, I can't work in a factory. So why not? I don't do well around people. I can't interact with people. It brings up issues. I've got a lot of emotional baggage. I just don't do people things. Okay, no problem. I'm going to put you in the factory. I'll give you a desk job. You'll be answering phones. You'll be a manager there. He goes, no. I can't do phones, because when the phone rings, it triggers something inside of me that brings up an association. I once got hit by a dodgeball in second grade, and I have these terrible flashbacks. I can't do phones. It's okay, I can't put you in the factory. I can't put you in the... What kind of job do you want? He says, I don't know. What else do you have? He says, well, I got a final option. I could give you something like an overseer of all the different parts of the company. At least you could do that. He says, no, I'm not good at managing things. There's rage in my family, and this one's a recovering alcoholic, and I've got a lot of issues. I can't take that job either. So the guy looks and says, what do you want to do? You won't take an office, you won't take a factory, you won't answer phones. He says, what am I going to do with you? So the kid says, look, it's simple, just buy me out. a lot of ways to make money these days. So Yaakov agrees to work, actually, for his father-in-law. He doesn't say, I can't do it, with a lot of answers, a lot of excuses. So I'll read in English. Lavan says, it's better that I give her to you than I should give her to my mother. Stay with me. So Yaakov works for Rachel for 7 years, but they appeared to him like a few days because of his love for her. And Yaakov came to Lavan, his father-in-law, and says, give me my wife. My days are complete. I want to get married. So Lavan gathers all the people of the place, and he makes a big feast. Now, Lavan was a big trickster. It came to pass in that evening that Lavan took his daughter Leah. Now, again, that's not who he was signed up for, right? He wanted to marry Rachel. So, no, he takes his daughter Leah, and he brought her to him, and he came to her. And Lavan gave Zilpah, the maidservant, and it came to pass in the morning, and behold, it was Leah. They got married. They had the whole wedding feast. They consummated the marriage. And the following morning, he wakes up and realizes, oops, I married the wrong girl. Could you imagine such a thing? The wedding's over. They paid for the caterer. They paid for the hall. They paid for the flowers. They paid for the band. And you realize that, oops, I went home with the wrong girl. I worked for you for Rachel. Why did you deceive me? Now, how many of you guys have been to Jewish weddings before? Yeah? Do you know what it's called? There's a certain time where the men dance in the groom, And he covers her head with a veil, right? It's called a bedekin in Yiddish. That it means that it's part of the marriage. It comes from this story. That the girl's face is covered at the actual wedding. But I got a very simple question. Look at this story. It didn't end the right way. No? In other words, think about it. The whole point was that he tried to marry one girl, and why did he get deceived? Because her face was covered. So as a reminder for this story, the first Jewish wedding where Yaakov marries the wrong girl, we're going to do the exact same thing. And every single Jewish wedding now, we're going to cover the girl's face. You can't see her? I don't know. Like, you could get caught by surprise. The wrong girl could be under there. Again, you don't know what you're going to get. So why is that the established custom at a Jewish wedding now? So we specifically make a point of it, that he goes and he covers her face. That's one question. A few other ideas just to throw out there a little bit. At the end of the day, I didn't put these sources on here, but at the end of the day, Jacob, Yaakov, has the majority of his children with the wife that he really didn't want to marry. Jacob, going back and forth to Hebrew and English, Yaakov had 12 sons. 6 of them came from his wife Leah. How many came from Rachel? From Rachel, how many?
Two.
Only two. So the majority of his children were with a wife that he really wasn't planning on marrying in the first place. And when they die, when Rachel dies, she's not buried with her husband. She's buried in Beis Lechem. Have any of you guys been to Eretz Yisrael? You've been to Israel before? Have you ever been to the grave? It's dangerous, but like you get the whole army escort, you can go, you can daven. It's one of its most unreal places to pray. People make a very special point of going to daven at the grave of Rachel. But Rachel's buried by herself. Her husband, who loved her, who worked so hard for her, is not buried with her. He's buried with Leah in Hebron, right? A little bit more south of Son. Has he been to Hebron, Maarat HaMechpelah? Yeah? A little bit? If you haven't, you're going. Rabbi Lewis should take a trip to bring everybody to. You went there. You went to Hebron. Excellent. So why is it? It's like poetic justice almost, right? Here he is, the girl he wants to marry. He doesn't have most of his kids with her. He got fooled into marrying his sister. And ironically, he's not really there with him. I just point out this: how did he get fooled? Jacob understood exactly who he's dealing with. He knew that his father-in-law was a crook, so he made a special sign that only he and Rachel would know. And then Rachel saw what was about to happen at the wedding. She saw that her sister was being taken in her place. And what Rachel did was the most unbelievable act of self-sacrifice. She showed the, quote, secret sign to her sister so that Yaakov would really think in the dark tent that he was with the right woman. Now, we know the end of the story. At the end, Rachel ends up marrying him as well. But she didn't realize that at that time. She gave up her husband thinking that she's never going to get to marry him. I don't know about you. I don't know about anyone nowadays who would be able to put up to survive, to overcome such an unbelievable challenge. At the risk of embarrassing her sister, she was willing to give up her husband. But ironically, because she was willing and able to give in, she benefited. She gained more than she would have gained if she would have insisted on, quote unquote, what was coming to her, what was due to her. Unfortunately, Rachel was barren. She was unable to have children according to the laws of nature. But because this unbelievable act that she did, Rashi, one of the commentators on the Torah, tells us, because she did this unbelievable act, Hashem rewarded her measure for measure. She broke down her natural tendencies, her desires, her human needs to have a husband. She overcame her natural tendencies, and she says, I'm giving over the signs to my sister. Because of that, Hashem rewarded her. He's going to overcome the laws of nature and enable a woman who's barren to have children. If she hadn't, if she had, says, no, he's my husband, I'm keeping him, great. They would have gotten married, but they wouldn't have had any children. And the Navi, the prophet, Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu says, he refers to her as Rachel Mevaka al Baneha, that Mama Rachel, Rachel cries for all the Jewish people, because in a certain respect, all of us here, whether or not we're biologically descended from Rachel, we're all in a certain aspect considered to her. She's like, we call her Mama Rachel. We call her the mother of all the Jewish people because of this unbelievable act that she had. I want to share with you an insight. How much time do I have? You have that time? Okay. A friend of mine, when I was in college at Yeshiva University, so there was a Chabad club there, where one of the students learning in Morristown used to come. And there's a very special, call him a young man at that time, his name was Rabbi Yossi Jacobson, Y.Y. Jacobson. And already then, years ago, I realized he was a very, very special Torah personality. There was something just unique about him. And this was going back 20 years at least. And nowadays, he's one of the most popular, sought-after lecturers. He gives online classes. I think like 10,000 people listen to his Torah weekly classes. He was asked to give a talk to the only Orthodox Jew was asked to give a talk to United States chaplains. Right? The whole, like 4,000 chaplains. They said these people knew the Bible backwards and forwards. He would start quoting a verse and they would like finish it. Like, you know, priests, ministers, they knew it. He said the difference between talking to Jews and non-Jews, that the non-Jews actually would turn off their phones when you asked them to. Right? Jews were like, you know, we're nervous, we're going to like miss, you know, could be like BB or Trump's going to be calling me. I can't turn my phone off because in case like he has to know what to do with foreign policy, I have to be available. But you don't feel annoying, like, you know, you're talking to somebody and like you get that little buzz and you think like it's like something really important, you find out it's like, you know, a coupon for Staples or something like that. So Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson suggests an idea that I want to share with you. It's based upon Hasidic teachings that yes, Rachel and Leah were two very real people, but there's also a metaphor behind it. There's a prototype, a metaphysical entity called Rachel, and there's one called Leah. And they represent two different personality types that exist inside of every one of us. Yes, again, they were real human beings, historical, who lived, they were unbelievable people, but it's also a message, a contemporary message that applies to us. So if you look at the name Rachel itself, do you know what the name translates into English? Rachel? It's a sheep. A light sheep, an ewe, E-W-E. So they're, you know, cute. Sheep are cute. They're so light. They're so fluffy. He says that Rachel represents the parts of our personality that are light, that are pleasant, that are easy to get along with, that are beautiful. Light in the sense of being, as opposed to heavy, and light in the sense of, as opposed to dark. They're the things that we like about ourselves. That's the Rachel part of our personality. That's the Rachel inside of each one of us, male and female. It's the things we put on our resume that when we want to talk about how wonderful we are, those are the Rachel aspects of ourselves. Because that's the name Rachel means. And we looked on the Torah describes her. It describes Rachel as being Yefas Marav, Yefas Tor, beautiful of appearance. And Leah, so what the word Leah really means? Weak. Tired. A struggle. Leah is also beautiful, but in a different way. Leah is about conflict, about overcoming adversity. The Leah aspect of our personality, those things that we have to work on, that we struggle with, those inner demons that pull at us, try to get us to places that we know we shouldn't go, put difficulties in our life. And everyone has this, male and female. We all have an aspect of Rachel inside of us. We all have an aspect of a Leah inside of us. And the trick is to work out how to connect to both of them at the right time and at the right place. In gematria, do you know what gematria is? Where you give a number value to a letter. Like an aleph is a 1, a bet is a 2, gimel is 3. So if we took the three letters of Rachel, resh, chet, lamed, would number 238. That's the number value for the word, the name Rachel. It's also the same numerical value of the phrase vayihi or, that let there be light. Rachel, Rachel represents light in our lives. It represents positive things, good things, happy things, things we feel comfortable with. But Leah is hard. Someone gave an analogy, you know, if Rachel would be like a ocean cruise, right? You know, it's like, you know, big boats that fit like thousands of people. And Leah would be like a battleship. Something that has struggles day in and day out. But we have both those aspects too. There's days, we have Rachel days in our lives, and we have Leah days in our life. But I think it goes more than that. The story of Yaakov marrying Leah instead of Rachel is not just an event that happened over 3,600 years ago. It's a paradigm of all relationships. There's the Leah part. Scares me a little bit. Makes me want to recoil a little bit. It challenged me. It shocks me. It shakes me up. And there's the Rachel part that just fits so perfectly. That works so well. When we date the Rachel aspect of someone else. But when we get married, we find out that we married Leah. What does that mean? Rabbi Jacobson was telling a story. He was once concluded a lecture. He was in Manhattan. And a woman came over to him afterwards and says, "You know, Rabbi Jacobson, can I talk to you?" He says, "Yeah, okay." She says, "You know, I want you to know that I dated my high school sweetheart for 18 years. For 18 years. Now, to date someone for 18 years in Manhattan is not such a, it's like, you know, every day, right?" So she said, "After 18 years, we decided we're going to start considering getting married." She says, "What's the rush? It's only been 18 years. Don't raise it." She says, "So after 20 years, we got married. And now we've been married for 8 months, and we're fighting all the time." She said, "I don't understand it. For 18 years, 20 years, things were so wonderful. Things were sweet. Never a problem. We were, you know, fantastic. And now we're arguing all the time." So I said to her, "Look, my dear lady, for 18, 20 years, you were dating Rachel. And now you marry Leah. There's a real person behind there. And for a date, for a 2-hour date, a 3-hour date, a 4-hour date, we could be pretty good. We can fool a lot of people. We put on our best facade. We're so friendly. We have scintillating conversation. We want to hear about what do you think about it?" He gets in the car and says, "Tell me everything that's happened within the last 24 hours. He looks nice. She tells him, "Okay, great. Now after for 2 hours, he's talking about it. Tell me everything last 48 hours and 72 hours. And then at the end of the day, he goes home to where he lives and she goes home to where she lives. And you know what happens when the guy walks into his apartment? So before he even gets past the threshold of the door, the shoes and the socks go flying off. One shoe goes in the north, one shoe goes in the south, one sock to the east and one sock to the west. There's no one there to tell him what a slob you are." So he plops down on the couch, he gets some greasy potato chips, pulls out some, you know, flat soda, and it's a chutzpah. He drinks the seltzer straight from the bottle. But there's no one there to tell him, "What are you, a disgusting human being, drinking like that?" So he flips through the YouTube and he wants to find some, you know, really intellectually developing, and he'll watch like cute kittens like playing with yarn for a good 2 hours, you know. And then he'll, you know, he'll find out what the latest hack is, what the latest thing is, and there's no one there to tell him you're doing anything wrong. He falls asleep on the couch. He wakes up at 2 o'clock in the morning. He waddles like a hippopotamus to his bedroom, where there's still laundry that's been there for the last 2 weeks, and he plops down and falls asleep until the next day. But on the date, he's Prince Charming and everything is chip chop, because it's Rachel versus Leah. She does the same thing. You marry her and you find out that she also has issues. She also got hit by a dodgeball in second grade. She's also got associations. But what's the poetic justice behind this? What is the Torah trying to teach us with this paradigm of Yaakov? Really, really, Rachel makes us feel comfortable. It doesn't challenge us. But if you're only willing to date a Rachel and you're not willing to marry a Leah, you're not ready to get married. Because getting married to a Leah, both the girl to the boy and the boy to the girl, means creating a space for someone else in my life. Someone that doesn't fit into my nice prepackaged ideas and conceptions. Someone that's not nice and easy to download like the newest app. It means there's a real human being across from me. And I have to pull back myself, my ego, and to create real space for someone else in my life. That's hard. That's hard. Because we have egos. We like things done our way, right? Like the New Yorker's prayer for patience. God, give me patience and give it to me now. We have things the way we like them. And when someone comes along that doesn't fit exactly into what we think we need, it's hard. It's very difficult. And these statistics we're talking about you know, these couples, the 50%, the reason is because people aren't willing to do that. People aren't willing. Yaakov works 7 years for one wife, 7 years for his other wife. There's 14 years of hard work in making a relationship because that's what it takes. And unfortunately, most people nowadays aren't willing to invest. And the rules in everything in life, not just in the bank, but the rule in everything is that you only get out what you put in. You only get out of a relationship what you're willing to put in. It's true by a job. It's true with children. It's true with friends. And it's true with other types of relationships as well. But people aren't willing to make that investment. And as soon as my phone breaks, get a new one. As soon as my relationship breaks down, get a new one. But that's not the Torah approach. Now, it doesn't mean you have to work with every single person. But when you're committed to somebody, it means a real commitment. And that, I think, as Rabbi Jacobson explains, the reason why at the Jewish weddings, we cover the bride. You know why we cover and we don't see her? What we're really saying is, you are the person I'm committed to spend my life with. You're the person I'm committing to marry to. There's parts of you that I don't see. I'm not only committed to marrying the Rachel aspect of you, I'm committed to marrying the Leah aspect of you. And that's specifically why we insist upon that veil being down. It has to be there because there's such a deep message. And again, it's the man doing it towards the girl, but it's the same thing. She's saying the same thing. Marriage is a two-way commitment. She's respecting that aspects of his personality. She says, and we don't know them yet. There's no way. We don't know ourselves. Philosophers, Baruch Hashem, thank God, who are married, we stand the way we were standing underneath the chuppah 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we're not the same people we are now. Life changes. People change. They grow. They adapt. Things come up. But a commitment, a real commitment, means that I'm going to embrace that aspect of you as well. And, you know, people have a hard time with that. They tell a story of a woman who's at a graveyard, and she's crying, she's looking at the grave. Why did you have to die? Why did you have to die? And so this man seeing, he sees her crying, and she's so miserable, he looks and he says, excuse me, ma'am, who's buried here? Why did you have to die? Why? Why? He says, man, whose grave is this? He says, this is my husband's first wife. When we go through life, when we talk about relationships, we have to be mature. The whole idea about having a successful relationship, again, in any phase, in any style, is the willingness and the ability to create space for the other one. Otherness is how Rabbi Jacobson defined it. If we can do that, if we can create a space, then relationships will be more than just 2 days like Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. There'll be 2 days like Simchas Torah and like Purim. We'll have wonderful relationships. We'll have meaningful relationships with people. But at the end of the day, Jacob is buried with Leah. Because at the end of the day, the two personality types are meant to fuse into one. The Rachel aspect of that person that so charmed us and we were so beloved by us, and that Leah aspect that's tired and weary and hard and difficult, the two come into one. And it's one marriage. It's one relationship. It's one model that Torah is challenging us to. And it's not easy. But things that are easy in life aren't meaningful. Things that are meaningful for us and things that we work hard at and we invest in and we put time and energy and resources, like they say, we put our kishkas into it. We put our kishkas are what? Your intestines, right? You know what I'm talking about, your kishkas, right? You put yourself into it. When you're willing to put yourself into something and into a relationship, so the rewards are exponential. You can't imagine how meaningful it is. I think it's wonderful that you guys come every week and study and learn more about Judaism and about your heritage. And I guess maybe if there's any questions, I know I've been speaking a lot, but are there any questions about some of the concepts that talked about? No? Can I end off with a story? How much time do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes? Oh, plenty of time. Okay. Plenty of time. All right. So, we talked a little bit about how giving in. And when a person gives in to something, you think, look, I'm the loser because I had a conflict and I gave in. The other person got the way. So Rachel, who gave in, she did it in such a way that Leah didn't even realize the extent of how much Rachel gave over to her. The Torah records a story where one of Leah's sons is out in the field and he gets these types of, they're called mandrakes, they're called dudoyim. He brings home these mandrakes from the field. And this was somehow a way of fertility that was going to enable to conceive. So then Leah says to Rachel, it's bad enough that you took my husband. You want to take my son's mandrakes as well? So Leah all along refers to Jacob as her husband. Now, Rachel, any one of us would have exploded at that. What do you mean? Your husband? He was supposed to marry me. He's my husband. I'm the one who gave him over to you. But what Rachel did was she gave it over in such a way, such a sublime message, that Leah didn't even realize that she was taking her husband. Many times when we do favors for others, we don't lose any opportunity to point out how much we did for them. Yes, I gave in. And at every single opportunity I have, I'm going to remind you as to how much I gave in. And not only will I tell you how much I gave in, I'll even exaggerate how much I gave in to make you feel bad about it. And some people have the chutzpah to ask to be reimbursed for the fact that they gave in. Rachel, Rachel did it in such a way, such a special way, that Leah didn't even realize what she did. So a story that I read recently from the writings of Rav Busu, a very special holy Jew who lives in Israel. He told a story about a family that booked a wedding hall, whatever, a simcha hall, entertainment place for their son's bar mitzvah. And they're ready, they had the date set, they had the keter, had everything planned out, and lo and behold, a few weeks before their party, their son's bar mitzvah, they get an invitation for a different boy for that same night in the hall. Now they realized that it was a one-room hall. It wasn't like, you know, like you're upstairs and we're downstairs. Here you have a beautiful shul, so there's lots of different rooms. They knew the place only had one simcha hall, one room. And now they're getting an invitation to some other kid's bar mitzvah on the night that they had reserved. So the father calls up the owner of the hall and says, what's going on here? I just got an invitation for them. He goes, oh my goodness. And he realized what happened. Yes, it's right. You booked the hall. It's your reservation. I made a mistake. I take full responsibility for the mistake. I'm going to call the other family and tell them what happened. It's okay, thank you. And he got off the phone with him. And they started thinking for a few minutes. Could you imagine getting that phone call? Could you imagine you're about to plan, you're a few weeks away from your son's bar mitzvah, and then you get a call from, by the way, the hall that you booked was really a mistake and you can't have it. The father gets back on the phone and calls the owner back and says, no, don't call the family. Don't say a thing to them. We'll make other arrangements. Don't say a word. And so, took a different night that the bar mitzvah was. They themselves went through all the stress and then the problem of rearranging their personal family simcha. But again, the bar mitzvah was changed. So when the father gets to the simcha hall on the new night of his son's bar mitzvah celebration, he gets there and he notices everything is so elegant. It's glamorous. Such a fancy, whatever it was, carving stations. Even more sushi than you have here tonight. Fancy desserts and everything, and he's surprised because this isn't what he ordered. This he wanted much more modest, you know, simpler fare, and he's feeling kind of uncomfortable because you know his friends know him, and this isn't something a person in his tax bracket makes a type of celebration like this. But his guests were coming; he didn't have time to go to the office to find out what happened here. So he's enjoying the whole evening, and at the end of the night. And then he goes to the owner to say, you know, what happened over here? This isn't what I ordered. He says, no. He says, well, I want to pay for the difference. He says, no. Don't pay anything. He says, well, I have to give something. It's not right. He says, no, you cannot pay a cent for this. He goes, why not? He says, well, after you had called back and rebooked the hall for a different evening, somebody else called after that, and they asked if the hall was available on this evening. And I said, no. I'm not making that mistake twice. I said, no, it's booked already. And the man says, you know what? That night is my father's yort site, and I want to do something special in honor of my father's memory. Whatever simcha, whatever celebration is being held in your hall that night, I want it to be the top of the line, and I'm covering the bill in loving memory of my father. So this man covered the entire bill for the new bar mitzvah celebration. It's a great story. What do you see from this? When you give in, you ultimately win. When you give in and there's a conflict, and again, giving in for a noble prize, it doesn't not mean for something that's wrong, and there's injustice, and there's something wrong in the world, you don't say, oh, just give in, be mvater, give in. No. But if there's something that's really a peaceful situation and there's an opportunity to give in, there's a good thing, hey, I'm going to lose. We only win. Rachel, quote-unquote, won. She had more children because she was willing to give in. This beautiful story about the bar mitzvah in Eretz Yisrael, the family won because he was willing to give in. There's a great tzaddik known as the Satmar Rebbe, and he had a common saying in his family that whoever gives in first wins. Ultimately, when we're willing to do that, and it's the same idea about relationships, when we're willing to hold back on our ego, what we think should happen, we're willing to do that. Sometimes it's making space for someone else's life. Sometimes it's making space for someone else's ideas or opinions or thoughts when they don't necessarily conform with what we think is right. But by giving in, we ultimately become winners. So I wanted to share that story, and I want to thank everybody for coming. And I hope we get a chance to get to meet more of you personally in the future. Thank you, Rabbi Lewis.
Yes. If anyone is around on Shabbos, AY Avest Yisrael is located...